Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program where we get to meet the people who make a difference in our community and in our lives. I'm your host, Bob Willard, as we visit with master conductor Julius Riddell. For the next hour or so, we will ask Maestro Riddell a few questions, play a little music, and get to know the person behind the persona. Julius, welcome to Profiles.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted to remake our acquaintance.
Well, it's been 30-some years.
Is it that long?
Yes, it has.
My God. Oh, yeah, of course it would have to be.
Julius, just so our audience gets to know you better, let me list a few of your accomplishments. Frankly, it's difficult to know where to begin. In one season with the New York City Opera, I heard you conduct Handel's Julius Caesar with Beverly Sills and Norman Tregel, and then also Ginastera's Don Rodrigo with a new Spanish tenor, Plácido Domingo. This is a pretty good way to describe your musical sensitivity and versatility. A broad expansion of over 175 operas and an equal number of orchestral repertoire have made him one of the few opera conductors in the world who can do all of this music so well. There are very few opera companies or symphonic orchestras that Maestro Riddell has not conducted. For 37 years, he was with the New York City Opera, 22 of which he served as general director and principal conductor. He received a Grammy for his recording of The Merry Widow. He has been honored for his support of the music of Kurt Weill. And he will open the Chicago Lyric Opera season with Carlisle Floyd's Susanna and lead the Metropolitan Opera in a performance of Tosca. You just did that this last season,
yes,
did you not?
Actually, I did, and it'll be Bohemes, actually. It'll be some Bohemes.
Maestro Riddell was the conductor at the memorial service for Diana, Princess of Wales, that was held in Central Park. And, well, we could go on and on and on, but let's talk to the man himself. Many great artists received their first important engagements and recognition because of your endorsement by engaging them early in their careers. What are the qualities that you recognize in a young talent that has let you know they've got it?
Well, I think it's something, it's a combination of things. It has to be, I mean, I remember, you know, we have certain roles that we use to gauge new people, to integrate them, to see how they perform actually in performance. That means after they've had auditions and we think they have talent, you know, the voice is there, the deportment seems to be there. How do they really perform on the stage? So there are certain roles. For tenors, it's usually Pinkerton. For bassists, it's usually Zuniga, for example. And that is because we're always cognizant of the fact that we may be misjudging. And if someone is not up to par, at least he's not destroying the whole performance. So we chose roles. You know, that's a sort of a little bit of a sneaky thing to do. But if a Pinkerton in Butterfly doesn't quite live up to it, we still have a chance. If the Butterfly is good and the Sharpless is good, Pinkerton doesn't come on stage for the whole second act anyway. So, that may be sounding a little cynical, but it's one way of really judging without harming the performance. And I remember a number of times I would react, and I would, of course, be in the house and listen and watch. And it comes to mind the man I'm going to do Susanna with, Sam Raimi. When I put him on for Zuniga, after the first act, I was so excited. And what does Zuniga show, really? I mean, it's a small role. And yet, when he stood on the stage, already then, it was like an absolutely tight arrow ready to be shot. You know, it was just wonderful. That was the way we would try out new talent, and if they were good, they would have their chances on a regular basis.
It's interesting you should mention Sam Raimi, because I recall that when after Norman Tregel died, that he stepped into a number of those roles.
He did.
And it was not like there was a great loss. It was the same kind of voice.
He was, and he still is, of course. He has that wonderful tension on stage that you feel, you know, that everything is taut as a spring, and it's good.
Well, but that's just, we've mentioned Plácido, we've mentioned
Trigl, Remy, yeah. Domingo, of course. I mean, Troyanos, Milnes, the number. It's a pretty good lineup.
But you were able to peg something special. It wasn't just on the stage. It was before when you first heard them.
Yes, it was. As I say, it's a combination of things. So the way somebody walks on stage, the way somebody would address you, you know, it shows a great deal.
Well, let me just sort of step back a minute then. When you're out in the hall and there's just you or two or three of your members mm-hmm. of your musical staff and someone comes and auditions, what are all the things that you look for besides what we've just talked about?
Well, it's the whole is made up of so many small pieces. You know, there's a piece of how does he look. First, I guess we should reverse it. So how does he sound or does she sound? I guess voice is still the large part of that equation. And how does she look? How does she walk? How does she seem? Is there an inner energy? Is there something radiating? Is there something hidden that could be brought out? And it's just a judgment call. One makes mistakes, sure. I mean, it would be impossible not to. But generally, the record hasn't been too bad.
Well, you are known as a singer's conductor. So there must be something. Do you work with these people to find out how they follow, the way they interpret a line?
Well, yes. It was for me always very essential to help the singers in their phrasing, in their breathing particularly, you know, and in their observation of the indications in the score. So that then translates in the performance in helping to push them along here or hold back a little there or whatever, you know, see how long the fermata should be or should move on without any stop. All these decisions that go into momentarily, I mean, they are decisions of the moment in the performance.
But some of that's pretty intuitive, though, is it not?
Well, I think it's second nature. That's what it probably is. You know, you grow up with it. I've been sort of hanging around the opera companies since an early age.
I noticed that there's a number of your alumni who are involved in the School of Music here at Indiana University.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the pleasures of coming here. This is my first real visit. You know.
But you might, could we just sort of mention who some of these are so that people are aware of who you had to touch with? I know of David Efron and Patricia Wise and Imre Palo. Well, they all speak very highly of the time that they have spent with you. So.
And I remember them very fondly, too.
Now, you have just had, well, last year marked your 80th birthday.
Oh, yes.
What is it about conductors that gives them such longevity? I mean, Stokowski signs a contract when he's 95. Toscanini, Walter, Klimper, Günther Vaughan, who was 90 when he just passed away. Mm. What is it about conducting, do you feel, that helps promote this longevity?
Well, I guess we get all our aggressions out, you know. I don't know. It is said that it's the cardiovascular road that we all take because naturally we have to do a lot of hand waving and arm waving, and supposedly that helps your cardiovascular system.
You mean that upper thoracic exercise and so forth?
I suppose.
But what about keeping the mind alert and alive?
Well, I think that goes with it. I would hate to think of someone who, you know, I can't even conceive of that not being alert and not being tuned in and sharp.
Well, let's touch on this just for one more minute, and then maybe we should take some music and a break. But do you interpret pieces differently now at 80 than you did, let's say, 35 years ago or 40 years ago when you were in your 40s?
Probably. Yeah, I think I can say yes. But don't pin me to as to what exactly the differences are, because you do each time you do something, you re-examine it. You know, you look at it as if you're looking at it for the first time, and you may discover some relationship or some something that you didn't pay enough attention to before. And that's the marvelous thing about the thing we are doing. Music is so open to further inquiry and to ways of different ways of doing it. We are all claiming we are true to the written note, but what differences are there between one interpretation and another? You know that.
Well, there are differences, though. Why don't we take a moment now and listen to some music with you working with some of the great artists you've worked with in your career? Why don't we hear something that you've conducted and something that's sort of identified with your career? How about a selection from the Buitos' Mephistopheles?
Fine. Let's do the Caballé singing the Altra Notte, a wonderful moment of craziness.
With the orchestra conducted by Julius Riddell. We have just heard a selection from Buitos' Mephistopheles with Montserrat Caballé and an orchestra conducted by Julius Riddell. Maestro Riddell is in Bloomington to conduct the Summer Festival Orchestra and the music of Richard Strauss, excerpts from Salome and Rosenkavalier. That keeps your orchestral and operatic world together, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. It's a nice overlap. I like it.
When did you first know that you were destined to be a musician?
Oh, I don't know that I was destined to be, but I had no fallback plan, so to speak. I had always expected I would be. I think from very early on, 5, 6 years old, I mean, I already knew I wanted to be in music. I wanted to do music. That's what interested me most. Music and theater, I will say that. I was also interested in that, and I dabbled in constructing little puppet theaters and putting on various scenic elements of various operas and so on. I always, from very early on.
Was your family theatrical, musical?
No, they loved music, they appreciated it, they loved theater, and they took me. I remember the first time I went to the opera. I do remember that, actually, the actual performance.
This is in Vienna.
In Vienna. I was 2.5. And it was a performance of Carmen. And Maria Yeritsa was Carmen. And I still remember some things about it.
At 2.5?
Yep.
That's incredible. Yeah. How many times have you conducted Carmen since then?
Ooh, I don't know. You know, I've never kept track, and I'm sorry now that I didn't. The number of Placido Domingo has a list, and he faithfully puts in every performance he does, under the proper heading, and I've never done that, and I regret that.
Why a conductor? Were you an instrumentalist?
Well, I was, yes. I started out on the violin and went to the piano. And I actually wanted to be a composer, but I didn't make it as a composer. I was very severe on myself and decided enough and stopped.
You came to the United States in what, 1938?
1938, yeah.
And that was to get away from what was going on in Europe at
yes,
the time?
Yes, indeed. That was the Holocaust and the Nazis and Hitler. And I was very lucky to get away fairly early.
And then you went to Manus School of Music?
That was my final, yes. I went to Manus School, graduated from Manus, actually.
And it was there you started conducting, as I recall.
Exactly.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, well, actually, it was a very cute thing. My first real engagement came because my to-be wife, I was courting a very young lady who was going to City College at night school because she was working in the daytime. And so she went to school, and yet she loved music, and so she joined the City College Glee Club. And the man who was in charge of the Glee Club wanted to do Mikado, and he didn't feel he was able to conduct himself. So my wife-to-be suggested this young man she had met and who could probably conduct it, would do it very happily, and it was me. And, of course, I did conduct it, and that was my my paid debut, so to speak.
Doing the Mikado. And from there you went to Tales of Hoffman
and Mephistopheles. Then, of course, then came the very fortuitous and unique opportunity. The City Opera was formed, and I was right there, and I was able to get in on the ground floor. And so I grew with the company. We started out with a season of 1 week and three operas.
Gypsy Baron?
Was my debut, my conducting debut at City Opera, yes.
That must have been tough, starting an opera company in New York with the Metropolitan so dominant.
Well, it was tough even from other points of view, from very practical points of view. We started out with nothing. We had no subscriptions. We had this enormous theater, over 3,000 seats, and so it was a matter of filling it each night from scratch. There was no audience basis. But it somehow survived a number of crises, number of changes, and one of those crises propelled me into the directorship.
And that's what you held for 22 years.
And that's I stayed in that for 22 years.
You've been a great champion of 20th century opera. When we've talked about Kurt Weill, Ginastera so far.
Yes.
Performing over 50 of them during your tenure with the New York City Opera. Is this also true of the orchestral repertoire? And then as a second part of the question, why are you so attracted to this repertoire?
Well, I think it's simply that we need to expand our horizons, and there has been a certain a prejudice against so-called modern music. I'll never forget, I went to a concert. My kids went to the High School of Music and Art in New York. And I went to one of they had concerts in which kids performed, and even kids who composed had their works performed. And I remember after one young composer had his piece done, I heard one parent turn to the neighbor and says, "It's all right, but why do they have to write contemporary music?" And I thought that was so so charmingly naive. There is always, there's the old argument that nothing good has been written since Puccini or Strauss or whatever, and which is really not true, because there were always the ratio between failure and success was enormously weighted in favor of failure. I mean, so many, if you look back at the 400-year history of opera, there are thousands and thousands of operas being written, or have been written in these 400 years. And I challenge you to name more than 50 at a sitting.
Well, I'm just thinking about the fact that you're opening the Lyric Opera with Susanna. I mean, that's very contemporary. I guess it isn't now.
Yes, it is. yet it is not. It is not what some people, say modern. The modern that frightens them. The modern of more austere Schoenberg or even Dalla Piccola. Although I of course don't quite agree on that. Naturally.
Well, Lulu and Wozzeck does exactly. Take a little listening.
Wozzeck is one of the great, great pieces of all time.
Well, now we have John Adams and...
Yeah, exactly. In a certain way, we have come around, which is nice, I think, to be able to utilize the voice in a more satisfying fashion, perhaps.
You are linked from those years with the New York City Opera with Beverly Sills and Norman Traigle, particularly Beverly Sills, whose personality far, I mean, is huge, besides her singing talent. Mm. What was it like working with people of that ilk, not just Beverly, but all of these other people?
It was easy as pie. I mean, we understood each other. They listened. I listened too, you know. We arrived at interpretations and at performances that were really of a piece, because we all had the same feeling about towards the work and towards how it is performed.
What is it that makes the performance of music for you so personal? Why is it that music soars under one conductor, for example, and just is just another performance with another conductor? What is it about that gets into you?
I don't know. I guess part of it is mysterious and will always be, you know. It's just like you meet someone and you right away have a certain feeling about the person. You like them, or you're wary of them, or you're concerned, or whatever. You know, I think that's what it is.
How often, then, does it happen in the midst of a performance, something sparks?
I don't know. Something happens, and something kicks off, a gesture, a phrase, something sets you off soaring into space.
That must be wonderful when it happens.
Yes, yes. And, of course, the thing is to then, once it has lifted off, is to maintain it up there, you know, keep the ball in the air.
Well, I heard a sports announcer once say that a close game is easier to announce than one that's loggy, mm-hmm. you know, where it's 10-2.
Yes, sure.
So this must happen in the same time in opera. So.
Yes, yes. I think once, there could be a number of reasons for something not taking off or for taking off, for that matter.
If someone comes into you with a score and say, here's an opera I've written, you've never heard it, and you look at it, is there anything is there a list of things that goes through your head to look for to see whether this has the germ to be a good piece?
Well, I suppose, yes. You look at it from the point of A, I think, feasibility. B, does it have anything to say? I've commissioned a number of pieces, some of which I've never done because I felt that what came out was not worth. I mean, the expense of mounting an opera is so high that you have to have a certain minimum belief in the work that you're going to put on before you really can do it.
Well, you've touched on something here, if I might ask. What pieces have you commissioned or done the premieres of?
Oh, God, I haven't thought back on that for a long time. Was The Crucible is one of them, Robert Ward, even won a Pulitzer, I think.
Well, the two Hinastera operas that we mentioned.
The two Hinastera, certainly. Douglas Moore, The Wings of the Dove. Miss Havisham, Argento, which to me was a tragedy. It was the last opera that I commissioned and mounted and conducted as director of the company. That was my last season as director. And it was a wonderful work and so right and so good, except that the last scene was too extended. Anyway, make a long story short, I had tried to suggest, because you can't go against the composer and the librettist who was hanging around as well. You can't, go against them. So I suggested that the last scene was not helping the piece. It was too long, and there was a way of making it work better. And the composer was with me, but the librettist was against me. He needed the whole thing, and it was pathetic how the audience had been very excited, and you could feel the approval. And then in the last scene, you felt it literally slipping away.
And you can feel that from the
pen. And it was so strong that I could feel that. Although, you know, generally, you're not too much aware of what the audience does. I suppose subliminally you are, but that was really so strong, clear cut that it was a pity. It was sad.
Have they ever?
Oh, yeah, I think he's rewritten it, and okay. I think it has been done and will be done again.
You mentioned that your kids went to the High School of the Arts.
Music and Art, yes, in New York.
What are they doing now?
Oh, well, they did not really. My son was, in fact, vice president for programming at WQXR, which is the New York's music station, and has... stopped that, but he's written a book. In fact, he's a writer now. He has written several books, but he has just written a novel a little while ago, which has the fascinating title of Imagining Don Giovanni. And it has gotten very nice reception.
Imagining Don Giovanni.
Yes, it is. It's a fictional book, but it's historic fiction, because it deals with the premiere of Don Giovanni in Prague, and it has everyone is in there was a real person, but some of the conjectures and some of the constructs, in fact, the whole idea is his. It's very imaginative, very entertaining, very amusing.
He did follow in the footsteps in a different way.
Different way. The girls, my two girls, did not continue, although they're both musical, but they went to their respective fields.
It doesn't have to follow, right?
No.
You have been acclaimed for your work with the music of Kurt Weill. I'd like to, if we could take a break here, is to listen to something of his that you conduct.
Let's listen to a short little piece from the Threepenny Suite, which is his reorchestration. As you know, the Threepenny Opera is really written for a tiny, tiny orchestra of nine. And then, I mean, there are some of these hit tunes became so famous and so sought after, so to speak, that Klemperer, I think it was, asked Weill to write a suite, to make a suite out of it. And he did, writing it for a somewhat larger orchestra, about 20-odd players. And, well, let's do the most popular of those songs.
Well, that's Mack the Knife, then.
Mack the Knife.
We have just heard Mack the Knife from the symphonic suite based on the Threepenny Opera of Kurt Weill, conducted by our guest today, Julius Riddell. Weill's an interesting composer. He did a lot of drama, a lot of popular tunes, and yet he was a serious composer.
Yes, yes. Well, he, in fact, started out, and he was a student of Busoni. Started out in Germany in the 1920s. It was very much the towards the cerebral, and he wrote good, solid music. But then he also felt the need to incorporate some of the at that time evolving jazz, and so he developed this. In very, very personal persona he had the great success, of course, with Three Penny. And he went into that direction. When he then, of course, fled, he came to Paris. And I recorded his Second Symphony, which is a very classically constructed theme, but the last movement is almost like a parody. It's very acerbic, but very, very music, sort of looking down on things. He has written, then he came to this country, and he felt that the musical would be, in fact, America's response to opera, the real generic response to opera. And so he felt, I mean, for example, from here on I go to Aspen and we'll do Street Scene, which is a wonderful piece and has all the humanity and all the emotional grit. It's a wonderful piece.
You've been treated well with music. It's your love, it's your passion. What are the principles that when performing music that guide your performance or your life?
I don't know. That's a deep question. I haven't pondered that. I feel, and I always did feel, that music is something very spontaneous and very, you know, mysterious. I still marvel. I mean, you look at something like a Mozart quartet, Haydn symphony, how a mind could conceive of this and structure it and so on. I think it's great. I've partake of it and I don't pretend to understand it.
Well, a quality that seems to come out, and you mentioned it when you were talking about the Miss Havisham, is the integrity of doing the music as written by the composer and not in porting your own belief in what needs to be done.
Exactly, of course. And yet, I mean, as we know, everyone interprets differently. Everybody has different points of view. Everybody has their own package to whatever they read and what they see and what they then perform. I find it always so amusing. Every conductor maintains, I'm only doing what's written. And yet the differences are so enormous between one and another. Interpreters, not just conductors, I mean pianists, instrumentalists as well.
With the longevity you've had as a conductor, what do you see as the difference in the conducting field today from what you started with as versus all the young conductors that we have on the scene at the moment?
Well, I think that young conductors that are going into opera, this is a generalization, and you know, all generalizations are only partly true. But I feel that many of them do not really have the prerequisite understanding of voice and of drama. And there are two things that really tick me off, and that is stage directors who don't understand the music and conductors who don't understand the drama. And it is music drama, and you've got to understand both if you're going to make it work.
Well, it's interesting because during your tenure with the New York City Opera, when you had like Frank Cassaro and Tito Capobianco and those, you had some great stage directors who helped enhance the musical performance.
And generally, you know, we came out all right. This was only very rarely that we misfired. I mean, even someone as clever as Corsaro sometimes misfired. But generally, he was right on because he was very musical. So was Capobianco, very musical. And that was essential. I will also say I'm not terribly fond of total reinterpretations of pieces, you know, where if you put Bohème on Mars or whatever, you know, I don't think that adds anything to it, or Tannhäuser in an airplane hangar or whatever it was.
Well, I think they put Bohème on the stage and called it Rent, didn't they?
Well, that's something else. As a matter of fact, that's funny. You know, as a piece, Rent, this is fine, it's okay, and I went to see it and I enjoyed it. And of course, the funny thing is that the one tune from Bohème that is being used has nothing to do with Rodolfo, with the two leads, as you know. It's Musetta's waltz song, which is, of course, given one of the most famous parts of it. But, I mean, that is sort of the thing, the hook on which the whole thing hangs.
Well, you've been involved with a lot of what we would call musical theater. Didn't you start with Kiss Me, Kate years ago?
Oh, yeah. I did that in Vienna. That was the first time an American musical was done at the Vienna Opera. Kiss Me, Kate. And that was my return to Vienna, actually, after the war.
How was that received?
It was fantastic. It still runs. You know, they do things in repertory. So it's still, they perform it still. I would hate to go see it because I mean, it was, when we did it and we fought hard because a little bit it was against the Viennese schlamperei. You know, we were it was very American in a sense that it was very tight and it moved and it was, you know, there were no lags in it and so on. And Viennese tend to be, you know, a little lackadaisical, and so tempo in a Viennese operetta, tempo often is a secondary concern.
When you did Candide with the New York City Opera, and it was Hal Prince, I believe, that directed it.
Yes.
How does that translate into Viennese? It was a wonderful performance because the audience was part of the stage, as I recall.
Well, I can't tell you. The only thing I can tell you that it took me a long time to get that. In fact, I didn't really get Candide because I couldn't get Hellman and Bernstein to agree. Both of them individually said, yes, I want you, because I wanted to do it. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. I felt it really fitted into our kind of repertory. And so I went to them and I said, I want to do it. And they both said, yes. And then Lenny said, but please, you've got to get Lillian to change so-and-so. And Lillian would say, but you've got to get Lenny to make some changes. Finally, they said, well, you do it. You do what you think is right. And I said, yeah, but I want that in writing. I wouldn't. And they would never give it to me in writing. And so I you know, it was a long time coming.
It sounds like sometimes it's easier to work with people who've passed on.
Well, there's less objection. Although sometimes the heirs will give you trouble, too.
Well, let's get back to this young conductor thing just for a moment here. We see a lot of these whiz kids. I hate to use that word, but they're already conducting massive opera performances without the experience of working them their way up as many of your protégés did. Mm-hmm. We can use David Efron, who was your chorus director.
Yes, yes.
Do you feel that this takes away their legitimacy as an opera conductor? Or?
Well, you know, traditionally, conductors in general, came out of the opera house, and they worked as coaches and pianists and rehearsal assistants and what have you, and learned the repertory, and learned the ins and outs and the needs, where to help a singer, where to move things and so on. They learned that in actual doing, and that process seems to have gone by the wayside. And so now young fellow steps in, and some of them are very talented and can do a reasonable job. But when I go to Aspen, I usually do an operatic master class for conductors. And it's astounding the naivete they bring to it. You know, they are so tuned in to the orchestral needs of a symphony. I mean, they treat the voice as if it were an oboe or a clarinet or whatever, an instrument, and don't give it, the human voice, the time to breathe or to stretch or whatever needs to be done.
Would you feel that that works better in the other direction when you're aware of when a breath or a rubato is needed with the voice? It helps the oboe player?
Well, yes, I think. But you see, that's where traditionally the conductor came out of the opera house. And those conductors who then had something to say musically beyond accompanying, say, an opera, you know, beyond just being accompanists, would enter the symphonic field. But Sell, Walter, Toscanini, you name them, they all came out of the opera house.
With all the repertoire that you have conducted, what, 175 operas and a great number
and
of
orchestral pieces.
Is there anything, any piece, orchestral or operatic, that you still have a dream of doing?
Funny you should mention that. Yes, there's one work that I haven't done, and I hope to somehow still do it. That's Parsifal.
Now, there's stamina. That'll take your upper thoracic exercise for a while, won't it?
Yes. It's a wonderful piece, and I love it, and yet it hasn't happened. I just haven't conducted.
Well, you're 80. You've got plenty of years ahead of you.
Well, let's see.
What would you say, then, that you would like to pass on as your legacy in the musical world?
Respect for the work, for the composer's wishes, but for the creator's wishes, because it should be, if you're talking about opera now, then it needs to be the consideration of both aspects, the musical and the dramatic.
Well, opera tends to have every element of the arts in it, it seems.
Exactly. That's why it's called opera, which actually means the works.
Let's finish with another piece, but let's go to Richard Strauss. And what would you suggest, Kiri Takanawai?
Yes, of course, I've worked a lot with Kiri at the Met and the Paris Opera and concerts. And we recorded, we did a record of German pieces. And there's a lovely Strauss piece, which is not often done. It's a bit of a rarity, the Egyptian Helena. And let's do a piece from that.
Well, let's do that as we leave. You've been listening to Profiles. Our guest today has been Julius Riddell, one of the most versatile and accomplished orchestral conductors and opera conductors of our time. He was in Bloomington to conduct the Summer Festival Orchestra. Julius, thank you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it was a great pleasure.
This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in July of 2002. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Copies of this and other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.